Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
Many years ago, a number of years ago, back when the stadium debate was going on here with the Ticats and Tim Hortons Field and Iverwind Stadium, when things were not going so well, people were looking around for a place to locate the stadium. And one of those sites that was brought up, never actually happened, obviously, was a plot of land right beside the GO station in Aldershot. Well, that was, as I say, cited as a possible sports location. It seems that that is back on the table. Burlington, a few days ago, had a meeting at which time there was a project that was brought up, and the city has been talking about this, that would have housing and commercial use and a university satellite campus, but also a 5,000-seat arena and a hotel and other things. Marianne Mead Ward is mayor of the city of Burlington. She joins us now. Mayor, thank you for doing this.
Thank you for having me. It's a great project.
Well, I heard about this, and you've probably known about this, obviously, for a long time, but I heard this and I went, wow, this is a huge project if it gets off the ground.
It is going to transform the city, but it's also going to transform the way that we develop around our GO stations, because that is where the bulk of new growth and our commitment to meeting our housing target that we've been assigned from the province, most of that's going to go around our three GO stations. But what we've said is we don't just want units of housing. That is a diminished view of what we can do here. We want jobs, we want community amenities. So a community center, meeting space, arena, ice rink, all of that would be in the right spot where there's enough land. We want to see all of that because we want people to be able to walk out their front door and literally to be able to walk to most of what they need. So the concept for 1200 King Road, which stretches from the Aldershot GO, it touches the GO on the westerly side all the way over to King, is really going to be the template for what we will see everywhere else on a bit of a smaller scale. That's a big parcel, but the elements of what will go there are exactly the elements we want to see everywhere else.
It really does. And there is a, I'll call it an image of it. It's a very loose image, but that's okay. It sort of gives a rough outline of what might be there. And it is, it's a pretty impressive thing if it gets off the ground the way that it's designed to, with housing, with commercial, with the entertainment district, with the campus, and again, right on the GO station. There's an awful lot right there.
And this is where partnerships are critically important. And I have to hand it to Alinea and their team for reaching out to post-secondary institutions, to the city. I don't know who else they're talking to as well, but they are very much saying we want to be more than just housing. And they have come to us really with a clean slate, if you will, a blank slate, and said, what do you want to see here? And that's unusual. Typically, a developer who owns land or any landowner will say, this is what I want to do. Can I do it? Instead of coming to the city first and saying, what do you need? What's your vision? And so it has allowed the city, our ECDEV department, tourism partners, our planners, council, and now the public, because this was an open public report, to actually set that vision before an application ever comes in through the front door. And then we're wrangling about it at that point. So this is, I hope, again, a new way of planning for major developments and major parcels, where we set the vision first and the rest follows.
I didn't see on here, and maybe I just missed it. I mean, what size are we talking about as far as residential units? I mean, how big a community, if you want to use that word, is potentially would be on this site?
Depending on, the height and the number of buildings, because it is such a large parcel and you can put housing over top of community amenities and restaurants and even grocery stores. I mean, that urban format of retail is really everywhere in major cities. There could be thousands of units here, tens of thousands of units. So that, that'll get refined through the process, but it is massive, and it will contribute, of course, if we get it done in time, to meeting our housing target of 29,000 units over the next 10 years. So this is a huge opportunity for us. not just to get those units, but again, to really reset how we as a city envision our future to unfold and how we're going to accommodate not just new residents, which we of course welcome to the city of Burlington, but all of the community amenities, the jobs, the services, everything that those residents will need within walking distance.
Where is it? So I read about this on the Burlington's economic development. It was a press release about the economic development. Where does this stand then? Because you've had a public meeting then. Mm-hmm. Has the city given its thumbs up to making this happen? Is this still in the exploratory phase? Where are we here?
We at council have endorsed that, like, this overall vision. We have directed our city manager to actually work with economic development to come back to us this quarter, so Q2, which just started a day ago. So by the end, you know, in the next 3 months, with investment opportunities. So this will refine in more detail what the land use would be or could be. Also starting to formalize the relationship with Alinea and any other partners that are willing to come to the table this early and or be identified through a letter of intent. So this was really the first, here's the overall vision. Do we think it's generally what we want to see? The answer was yes, big thumbs up from everybody. Now go away and do some additional work, and each step will formalize and finalize until we actually get to an application that we can review, but also starting to formalize partnerships. And that's partly why ECDev is leading this. So they're a bit arm's length from the city. They're not a department of the city. So they can entertain confidential discussions with anyone that wants to partner and perhaps come and be that educational facility or, rent some of the space in the new arena. They will lead those discussions on our behalf, and we are focused on the overall vision and making sure that the elements are what they need to be and there's no gaps.
So this is more than dipping your toe into the water here to sample it. This is beyond that.
Well beyond that. We are committed to seeing, so certainly us at the city and the landowner are committed to seeing this vision come to fruition, and it will be refined as it needs to be and tweaked through the process. But the overall elements of needing really three broad things: housing, community amenities, and jobs and services, and parkland. So there's four things really that we need to see on this parcel, and the initial vision has all of those. Where those are located, what the scale and size of those are, will be refined later in the process. But we've basically endorsed the concept that this is not just going to be a vertical subdivision of housing. This is going to include a number of other pretty impressive and pretty big components to it.
One other thing, because we're short on time. If you're going to build, or if they are going to build, a 5,000-seat arena that could potentially expand to 7,000, you don't do that for minor hockey necessarily. There's presumably a thought behind it. I know Burlington has in the past talked about looking at an OHL team. Would that be the idea behind this?
We want that facility to, first and foremost, be what the community needs. But we have heard from members of our community that they can't attract, for example, sports tourism, which is increasingly lucrative, holding big tournaments. If you were to get a team, a professional level team, there might be additional partnership money that can contribute to this. So everything is on the table, but the lead focus is what does the community need? And we know we need more ice space. Our users have told us that loud and clear. And we also need bigger venues, and not just for an ice rink, but we don't have an entertainment facility of that size in the city of Burlington. We've heard from our community about their desire to look at something like that as well. So, you know, arenas can be built in a way that is quite convertible. I think I saw my very first concert in the arena that was attached to a university in Kingston back in the day, April Wine. I know I'm dating myself.
A few years ago.
But yeah, a couple of years, you know, but you take the ice out and it can be used for all kinds of things. I go to when they have the cadet review every year, they troop the colors out on the ice, on the arena. But we have limited space in all of our arenas. They were built for an era and a size when Burlington was, you know, a quarter of the size in terms of population as it is now. We are bursting at the seams. So we're ready to have that conversation with the community about, you know, is this something, you know, the next step of our evolution as a city? And certainly we've heard from a lot of our ice users, and that includes more than just hockey, of course, but we've heard from folks that we need more facilities and we need something bigger. So everything is on the table right now. And if we can get somebody to help pay for it, I'm all in.
Marianne Mead Ward, Mayor of Burlington. Thank you for doing this. Really appreciate it. Interesting time. Interesting discussion. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Scott.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
This week we learned that Kohl's, which was one of the six remaining original tenants in the mall that opened in 1972, is going to be closing this spring. And it has raised, I think, questions for a lot of people about, well, maybe it's about Kohl's and Indigo, or maybe it's about, is there still a viable business case long-term for a downtown mall? Let's bring in Marvin Ryder from the DeGroote School of Business. Marvin, how are you today?
I'm fine, thank you.
Let's go to that one first. Is there malls in the suburbs people can drive their cars to and you can walk around and then load your stuff into the car and go home? Is there still long-term a viable business case for a downtown mall?
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to answer your question, but if you don't mind, just a little context for that question. When Jackson Square opened, and as you noted, not named for the Jackson Five, but former Hamilton Mayor Lloyd D. Jackson, when it opened in 1972, it was supposed to be a high fashion mall, and it was connected to a high fashion retailer called Eaton's. And so it was seen as complementary. And back in 1972, Lime Ridge Mall in Hamilton was kind of an afterthought. It's sort of where the Woolco was. It was the downscale mall. And what's happened over 50 years is a complete role reversal, where the high fashion mall ceased being the Lloyd Jackson Square Mall and became the one on the mountain, Lime Ridge. And what's happened to the downtown mall over 50 years, not necessarily by good planning, but more by default, as certain businesses have come and gone, not the least of which was Eaton's, a major anchor. Today, Lloyd Jackson Square is a value mall. It emphasizes a good value, low prices, really products in the mainstream, nothing of terribly high fashion. Are downtown malls destined to die? No, you can evolve them over time and you can change the mix of stores to something that appeals to the people who visit there. And clearly the suburban people, they just don't come downtown. They have no reason to be downtown. They don't work in downtown Hamilton, and therefore they keep all their shopping out in the suburbs, not the least of which would be up at Lime Ridge or perhaps even over in Burlington. What the Jackson Square Mall has to do is adjust to the people who come in there, the people who live downtown, who walk in off the street. So Kohl's will be replaced. They will find other people to move in there. But I suspect, again, this value mall focus is going to get reinforced.
And the irony of what you're saying, and I think what you're saying makes a ton of sense, but the irony of what you're saying is we're about to launch a $280 million renovation. Well, not us, Oak Ridge, whatever it's called. I can't remember the name of the group now. Anyway, the group that's doing the stadium renovations, Oakview, thank you. Oakview Group is about to start a $280 million renovation of the arena, which is attached to the mall. And the argument behind it is we're trying to upscale the arena. We want to make this an entertainment district. People are going to come down and have a nice night out. Will bringing the level of the arena up also draw the level, what you're talking about, it being a lower level or a bargain mall, will that drive up the mall, or will the mall hold back the idea that we're going to make the arena a high-end thing, or will they have nothing to do with each other?
No, they will be definitely connected, but to your point, I short answer is I don't know. I like what the people are trying to do with the arena, but remember, it's a multi-year project. And when they get done, we'll all have to see what is the result. If it is simply window dressing, to quote Sarah Palin, putting lipstick on a pig, then no, I don't think things will change. But if they really do fundamentally change things, then yes, the people who come to the mall themselves might change. Maybe, Scott, give an example. You know, later this year, we're going to be hosting, Hamilton's going to be hosting the Canadian Open. And a number of the professional golfers choose to stay at the Sheraton Hotel, which is seen as a bit more of an upscale hotel in the greater Hamilton area. But inevitably, the spouses and children of those professional golfers who are staying at the hotel, then when they want to run out and grab something, they run into Jackson Square Mall, and they always complain about it. Yes, we're across the street from the Hamilton Art Gallery. Yes, we're near some other points of interest in Hamilton. But gosh, this is what you've got. Where are the Ralph Lauren outlets? Where are the Tommy Hilfiger outlets, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And so I'm sure the Sheraton would love to see a better group of people, a more affluent group of people come into that mall. And it could happen with that renovation. We also know that the former Eaton Center Mall is going to be demolished and replaced by a number of condo towers. Over what time period, I'm not sure. That might take 10 years or more to all come to fruition. But if you attract those people to live in a space that is contiguous with Jackson Square, they can change the face of it. Malls tend to evolve that way based on the people who come in, where once upon a time we had major industries. The Stelco Tower is part of that complex. Stelco had all those employees in there. They've disappeared. It will ebb and flow. Change the mix of people coming in. You change the mix of stores.
Because, yeah, and I mean, obviously what you're saying, again, it makes a lot of sense. And I wonder if the idea is we're going to have all these people coming for concerts, which is supposed to be now the number one thing in other entertainment. You know, if you were to, let's say, not have, well, you still have a food court, but if you use the number of those storefronts right now and turn them into restaurants or something like that, it could be the synergy kind of thing that you build up downtown.
Yeah, exactly. And so Kohl's, of course, is getting out of the mall. Heather Reisman, who's behind the Kohl's Indigo group of people, are saying, basically, I can't afford to be there anymore. I'm not getting people walking in who want to buy books. Books themselves are dying thanks to the internet and all those nice electronic devices we have. And I'm not sure Kohl's is a sign of a bellwether of change in that way. It's more of a technology change. It's not a system change. But if you bring people who want, I don't know, jewelry purchases, you'll have more jewelry stores. If you buy people who want or bring in people who want high fashion items, you'll have more high fashion stores locate there. You always fish where the fish are. But at the moment, the fish who are coming into that mall don't attract that same high interest group. Dollarama does blockbuster business in that mall. The banks are still doing good business in that mall. The cinema is doing good business in that mall, but not all the stores are doing as well as they once did. That's why Roots has disappeared. That's why Kohl's is disappearing.
And you know, you mentioned it, one of the great theaters in this city to watch movies, the way they've got it set up, they've adjusted it and made it. I give full credit to the theater there, because once upon a time, again, I don't know that everyone wanted to go down there. They changed it so they've got the reclining seats. I think they were the first one in town to do that. And they've made it so, you know what, it's actually worth my while to go down to Jackson Square to go to a movie at those theaters. If you can do that with a lot of other ones, maybe you're, as you say, maybe you're onto something.
Yeah, the one challenge, of course, you have when you come, if you're more of a suburban person, is the cost of parking. So when you compete against a suburban mall like Limeridge that has all of that space tied up in quote-unquote free parking, and then I could come downtown and enjoy that wonderful theater, but now I have to pay $10 or $15 or $20 to park, it's not such as an enjoyable thing. So these things go hand in hand. If you have more people living downtown and working downtown, you will change the face of that mall. If instead you're relying only on people who commute and drive, again, you change the face of that mall.
Marvin Ryder from the DeGroote School of Business. Always brilliant having you on. Thank you for doing this.
Glad to be with you.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
This weekend is going to be a special concert, the 50th anniversary concert for Teenage Head. And I don't know, if I think it through, maybe another local band comes to mind, but I'd have to spend a little time kind of trying to come up with another Hamilton band that is as synonymous with this city and has been doing it for as long as Teenage Head has. Dave Rave and Gene Champagne in studio with us. Guys, thanks for coming in.
Well, thanks for having us.
I'm honored to be here. Thank you, Scott.
This is, now I know you guys weren't there from day one, but nonetheless, 50 years is an astronomically long time to be a band.
Well, I guess I was there from day one because I was the first singer when they did their concert.
Okay.
On Hillview Street.
Really?
Okay. In 1975. Yeah, we did a Frank Stad had cordon the street off. We got the permission. I don't know how that happened, but we played in Frank's driveway.
Yeah. In front of how many people?
Oh, the block. It seemed like a big crowd at the time.
I'm sure.
Probably 100 people or something like that. Everybody had their lawn chairs out. It was a real family Hamilton thing. It was August of 75. I remember pretty well.
That's cool. But it's 50 years is a long time to be a band that still wants to do it, especially when, and Gene, I mean, this is something, again, that I'm always amazed by when I see artists or groups, especially who have had songs that people love. You're almost obligated to play those songs every time you strap on the instrument.
Yeah.
That's a lot of times to play those same songs.
They want to hear the hits.
They do.
They always want to hear the hits.
Do you ever get bored of doing it? Or are you always like, they get excited, so I'm excited?
No. You know what? I grew up on Teenage Head, too. And I still love playing them. They were my favorite band growing up. And, in a way, they all taught me something. So when I came into the band, I already knew all the music. It was just really easy to do. And I always try to play true to some of Nick's style. But I certainly have my own style that I bring into it as well, just because that's what I do.
How did you find, before you joined, how did you become a fan? What was it that brought you into that?
Probably CKOC, being in my mom's car, mm-hmm. driving around, she'd have CKOC on, and I'd hear them, and I knew what I liked. I really didn't understand it more until a little later in life. I kind of went backwards. I actually had I think I had Frantic City first, and then I went to the first record after the fact, and then I got them all, of course.
How did this all then start, Dave? Was this all? That's the fans. See the fan hotline.
Trying to get rid of this. I thought I took my my things off.
That's okay. The fan hotline. They always can get through.
They can get through. How did all this begin?
Yeah.
Well, you know what? To be honest, it was an ongoing thing, and it was a high school thing, just across the street here from C.H. Mel's Westdale. And Gord and I grew up from grade one.
Wow.
That was we went to Christ the King School, and then we both ended up at Westdale High School, and then from Westdale to Mohawk. I met Frank at Westdale grade 9. I met Steve when he played baseball. Nick, I was a little later because I didn't know Nick that well, but I knew those three guys pretty good. So we were always talking music. Steve and I were in chemistry class together. We were in math class together. You see, it was a casual band. It wasn't like suddenly.
Always this style of music, though?
Well, the influences of the band. Frank and I were a little bit before Gordon and Steve, so we were more into, I guess now they would call power pop.
Okay.
Badfinger and whatever was current, Free and all the bands. But Gordy and Steve, man, they were right into the Dolls, right? Stooges, that style, Alice Cooper, right from the beginning. So they were pioneers. Those two guys were right into it. Steve had those, what do you call those shoes he made himself, the platform shoes.
Oh, yeah,
he
made his own platform shoes.
Yeah, they went to glam rock, New York Dolls. Nobody was into that music, and they were into it. And I thought this really was cool, right?
You mentioned Gord, obviously, and you mentioned Frank. And let's deal with this early is not a morose thing. But, there is something missing on Saturday when you perform, because those are two guys who are, really as synonymous with the band as 100%. Anybody else is, and there's some tragedy involved in this band.
Oh, always, yep, absolutely. But we always try to. Well, you say it best. Go ahead.
Oh, I just say we like to carry it on. Mm. It's a continuity. Like those two guys are brilliant. So mm-hmm. is Nick too, but Steve is, and Gene played with the boys 10 years, right?
I played with Gord before that.
And he played with Gord before that. They had a band. I think. you know, we know the tragedy for the people out there because we felt it too. Mm-hmm. And but so we think it's our job to carry it on.
Was there ever a thought, either when Frankie died first or then when Gord died, was there ever a thought, you know what, we can't do this without them because they're so much a part of this?
I don't know. Well, in the 80s, you got to understand, Frank left the band and Nick left Back Then.
Mm-hmm.
And Gord said to me, you're singing. That's one reason why I became a singer. It was no big, I was playing rhythm guitar. And Frank and Gord and Steve just said, you're singing now. Well, and I just felt it was a duty. I had to do it, you know?
If I can just interject.
Go ahead, you can interject.
I mean, if you think about the times, too, when Frank left. And all of a sudden, okay, Rave, you're singing. It wasn't like the days of social media where you're saying, hey, we got a new singer. It's just show up and get spit on. So, you know, you had to persevere.
It was scary. Rave.
Was it?
It was. But, you know, but to be honest with you, though, I know that when we lost Frank, which was just so sad,
mm-hmm.
you know, what a loved guy. And I loved him. And anybody ever asked me, they always go, you know, what's it like? I go, I love him. I'm just carrying his work on. He made me laugh. I was a fan of his. But, you know, but more than a fan, we were brothers, too. You know, I think all of us were. And so I'm just saying, you know, I can still hear him when we're playing sometimes. Come on, Raver. Give a little more. Come on. I can hear him. And I think we feel that way with Gordy, too. You know, Gordy's in us, giving us the backing, you know, like to keep playing.
I know that every band that's been around for a while, not necessarily 50 years, but every band that's been around for a while has a moment or something that people will remember. I mean, clearly Teenage Head, I don't know if you guys like the fact that, you know, so many people remember the Riot that became so famous. And it almost sets a reputation of, oh, this is the Riot band. And I know that's unfair because I don't think that's, but do you ever shake that kind of thing? Or when people come and talk, is that always one of the very first things they all want to talk about? Because it was such a huge story at the time and made, frankly, whether for better or for worse, I think introduced an awful lot of people to the band.
What I find sort of, because I'm the latecomer to Teenage Head is and also being a fan, is that when people come up, they always want to tell me when they first saw the band. You know, sometimes I don't even think they realize that I wasn't even around at that time. And I'm like, yeah, man, everybody's got a story. And the one thing I always told Gord is I so respect that they earned each and every one of their fans, because it wasn't like they just played these huge festivals all the time and, you know, like records companies just throw you out there and see if it sticks. They played the bars every night.
It was a grind.
It was a grind, and they built every single fan, and every single one of those fans has a story to tell about him, about the first time they got to hang out with him or meet him, and that carries something huge, and I admire that because not a lot of bands can say that, and I watch it every night. And you know, when Gord was with us, I'd walk in a room with Gord and I could see people that I wouldn't think gravitated to him would do that. And it was like, okay, wow, like this guy's had such incredible reach. It was it gives me goosebumps, actually.
I remember one moment I was watching TV and Frank was on CH the night show or the afternoon show with Dan. Remember Dan?
Yeah, Dan McLean.
I remember they were so excited to have him on. He was with Randy Steele and him were playing pool together. And Frank was being Frank, nice shot. You know what I mean? Like, totally funny and being his own self. I was laughing watching it. But Dan and the whole staff, you know, respected him and gave him this love that I was proud. You know, I was proud that he still has that light, that those guys were all, you know, these hardened guys who always interview people all the time were happy that he was in the room and being himself, like not pretending to be on television and being anybody different, like, yeah, nice shot. Okay, great. Take another one, Steel. You know, and it was fun. I thought, man, this guy's something else, you know. It made me appreciate him as who he is.
So, Gene, if everybody has a story when they come up, what are some of the stories that you hear? Because you may have been there for some of them, or you may just be, they may be telling you because they remember. But what are some of the big stories or the most commonly
big stories?
Well, the most
common thing is a lot of Frank stories about how they, you know, they sat up and they drank with them or they partied with them, you know, that
Ontario one, Place, that, of course.
Ontario Place. Right? Yeah.
You're saying?
The first time they saw them at high school.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many different stories.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, I guess what for you then, what was your moment, like
my,
when you
my
met
favorite,
Frank and
my
Gordy's
favorite moment was
for yourself, you know.
Well, Gord and I were friends back in the 90s. I used to drum for the Killjoys, and Gordy was a fan, so he would come to the show quite often. We were friends, and I remember I hadn't met Frank really back then. So he introduced me to him. We were somewhere here in Hamilton. He says, oh, he walked up with Gordon. Gordon goes to Frank. He says, hey, Frank, this is Gene, my friend Gene here. And Frank gave me the classic F you. And Gordon just kind of smiled and shrugged his shoulders. He knew what, and then he said, well, that kind of means he likes you. And I was like, that was like a badge of honor. I loved it.
You mentioned about the Killjoys and other things. Where among musicians in Hamilton is Teenage Head always considered? I don't know what like the one that everybody knows.
Yeah, I think so. At the top,
At the top, that's what I mean.
Yeah, I think so because they were, and they are still in a way. You know, like all of us. You know, I played with them, but I was also opening for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So we have on Gene too. You know, we all have Gene took care of Gord really musically for a while because I think it's because of your respect. I'm not putting words in your mouth. That's true, isn't it? Like your love of Gord was strong, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Musically, you know, you always made sure he sounded great. His gear was perfect, right? And his songs were being well played, right?
Well, I didn't know Frank. I don't know that I ever met Frankie, but I knew Gord pretty well. And I got to tell you, when you consider that Teenage Head has always been categorized as a punk band, fair or not, I mean, whatever that means, Gord is like the least punk
you'd ever meet.
You'd meet the guy and you'd think he's an accountant. And then, you know, he gets up on stage and he's playing. It just seems to me so odd the personality. I don't know all the personalities of the guys who have come through, but boy, it sometimes seems like is it an act? Is it a stage presence? Or what is it when you get up there and become Teenage Head?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think Gord was sort of, I don't think he realized, he knew Frank had all that swagger, but I don't think he realized that he had that same kind of swagger that I saw.
Mm-hmm.
I know he didn't recognize that.
Yeah?
I don't think so. He knew well enough that he had to turn it on when he got up there, but I don't think he realized off the stage he still had that, I don't know, he could light up a room, you know?
But is there something, though, there has to be something, and I don't think it's just Teenage Head, it's about just music. Is there something that a flip switches when you step onto the stage that you become a different person?
Yeah, I guess, you know, it's funny. I remember I used to do in the 80s bowling with John Priestner, the quarterback linebacker for the Cats. We became to know each other. Every year we would be our team. And he would say to me, oh man, I could never what you're doing, get in front of people and have them watch you and do that. And I'd go, well, I couldn't do what you do, being on field and everybody booing or something like that at Iverwind Stadium. And he goes, well, at least we don't see them. We can look at each other. But no, I think there's something that happens, some magic that you transform. Like, you know, Gene and I on stage, I'm looking at him. He's no longer Gene, this guy. He's the drummer and he's shouting instructions. He's keeping us moving, and I'm playing off as his energy, and I'll look over at Steve, and Steve is like intense.
It's,
you know, it's magic, isn't it?
It really is. There was a photo that somebody sent me that I still have, and it's one of my favorite photos, and it's a really dark photo, and it's everyone. It must be either at the beginning or an end of a song where we're all focused in one spot, like they're all kind of looking at me for like where we're going to end or where we're going to begin the song, and it really caught it for me. It was like, okay, this is a moment where we're all one.
You're all locked in the exact same thing.
All locked in and we're one.
Yeah, kinetic. It's a kinetic energy or something, you know?
We people grow tired of stuff. You know, if you hear it or taste it or smell it, but 50 years, people will still listen to Teenage Head songs. They'll obviously still come out. They'll still dance. They'll still play. Is there ever a surprise that a song can last this long and still maintain the love that people have for it?
No, I don't think so. Look at radio today. You know, people want the familiarity.
Yeah. But it's like for some people, they've heard these songs, well, for you guys, hundreds of times, hundreds and hundreds of times, still love it.
Yeah, it takes them back to a place, right?
There's that joke I was telling last night, yesterday, we were all sitting around talking. I remember seeing The Simpsons where Randy Bachman is on BTO run, and Homer and the whole gang are in there, and he's going, I'm going to play a new song. And all Homer and I go, no, okay, I'm going to do taking care of business. Yeah. And then they go, get to the chorus. Don't even do the verse. You know, like that's how fanatic people are about the music they love. they just, you know, it's a fun poke of how devoted people are.
Okay, so when you're up there,
you know, yeah.
When you're up there, what is, when you start in or you started, what is the one or two Teenage Head songs you know immediately you'll have that BTO on The Simpsons reaction to?
The obvious one
is Let Shake.
When he hits that drum beat.
Disgusting for sure.
Yeah. Some Kind of Fun.
Some Kind of Fun. Infected for some people because of the whole epic ending. They know Gord's going to ramp up and go nuts.
Yeah.
There's a few.
Picture My Face.
Yep.
People love that one.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I'm never tired of those songs. You know, I love them. Like, you know, when he starts Let's Shake, it's at the end of the night, I'm a little kid. I just jump in the air and start, you know, there's something infectious in that groove. And I've played that song around the world, not just with Teenage Head. I did it England, New York, you know, and every time it's played, and the audience reacts the same way. Doesn't matter where it is. So it's a song. It's Teenage Head put it together, but it's still that groove. It's magic.
You mentioned Picture My Face. That was the name of the documentary that came out. Two years ago, give or take?
Just before, completely lose track of time.
But anyway,
yeah.
So a little while back, that comes out, and if people didn't see it, I'm sure they can find it online now or somewhere else, but it was, does that do anything to introduce you to a new audience, or do you think that the people who watched that were all Teenage Head fans who wanted to see what that was all about?
I think both.
Probably more the latter.
Yeah,
that was for the fans, but I'm sure that it introduced some new people. But I find that now with this band anyway, that you see cross generations. You see kids coming with their parents. They said, "Oh, my dad had your record, and I came, and wow, you guys like are really good."
Yeah, they have to have heard these songs at home or in the car or whatever.
It is interesting though. Like I was in there's a record store in Oakville, and the guy who was behind the counter was a British guy. Who didn't grow up with Teenage Head, grew up in British punk rock.
Okay.
And he saw the movie for the first time, and he'd heard about Teenage Head. And he said to me with that British accent, he goes, "Wow, what a story, you know?" Like, and he shook my hand, fantastic. Now, he became a big fan, and because of that movie, he got all the records. So he did both, you know?
Now, do they know that you guys, like, there are bands that are so famous right now with social media and everything else that every member of it, their face is known everywhere. Yeah. I don't know. When you walk into a store, does everybody know that you're a member? So when that comes up, if it does come up, and you say, "Oh yeah, I play for Teenage Head," what do they say? What do most people say when they find out that that's who you're with?
Oh, it's usually cool. Cool, and then they'll have a story. Oh, yeah. I saw them back in blah, blah, blah. But the funny thing about that documentary was, you know, they followed us around for years doing that. I think it was 3 years.
Yeah.
And when I think about that, I think about some of the shows that we did. For example, we were doing Lee's Palace or wherever at the time. And I think, those people don't know how lucky they were to actually be at that show at that time, because it was such a struggle with Gord, with his health and his mental health and stuff. I mean, we lived it for 3 years, but I just think, wow, they're fortunate they got there to see that.
For sure.
And the other thing that happened with that film, I don't know what kind of time we have, is the ultimate plan was we wanted to take it across and preview it and, you know, kind of tour it and do some shows with it. That all happened, COVID hit and just shut it down.
When you mentioned that though, Lee's Palace or wherever, I got to believe that an awful lot of Hamiltonians, even if they never set out to see Teenage Head, have seen Teenage Head because, I mean, you played at the Grey Cup a few years ago. You played at the Labor Day game, I think maybe.
Yeah.
I remember 2003 or 7. Teenage Head was playing at the corner of Bay and York before a Bulldogs playoff game.
I remember that.
If you're in this city at some point along the way, you've probably come across this.
Part of the, even there's that big picture of Frank at that cafe now on Rebecca Street.
Mm.
I call it Frank, you know.
Yeah. Could have been a statue.
Yeah, but it's a nice picture. It's a beautiful picture, you know, great art. And no, it's part of the city. You know what? And isn't that your dream come true in your life? Is just to try to make some small contribution to the world, you know, especially your city, because it's where you're from. It's where you grew up. And, you know, I lived away from the city for a while, you know, and to come back, the love is still there. It's real touching, you know, it's moving. And they let you know that. It double, you know, like after the movie was done, I found really weird things. I remember I was up in Northern Ontario at this cottage. We were allowed to go away for a while. These guys on the roof saw the movie. You know, great, thanks. And I'm like, really? Yeah. You know, it's just two guys working on their house in a small town up in Northern Ontario. You know, they'd seen it and they want to acknowledge it. And it's beautiful when that happens, you know?
It's, as I said, off the very, very top. I maybe if I sat down and gave it a lot of thought, I would come up with another band that is more Hamilton than Teenage Head. But off the top of my head, I'm not coming up with one. And yeah. 50 years is an amazing thing. Very quickly, Gene, Saturday,
April 6th at Carmen's in Hamilton,
yep.
Carmen's yep. Banquet Center. Doors are at 6:30. Michael Lewis, Gordy's nephew, is going to be yep. opening the show. He did the Celebration of Life, too, and he's just amazing.
Yep.
Great voice, great player. Looking forward to
I
seeing him.
I think I coached him in baseball.
Yeah. Is that right?
Now that you're saying the name, I'm pretty sure I did. So didn't know he played music, but I'm glad to know.
Part of continuing the tradition, too, having him
sure.
there. I think
sure.
Steve and Gene really want that to move forward, you know.
Absolutely. And tickets are still available?
Some tickets are still available, but I suggest getting them.
Where do they go to get them?
Go to eventbrite.ca, or you can just Google Teenage Head 50th, and a link will come up. I know that. And yeah, I suggest getting it. And not only is it a show, I want to make note that it's a memorabilia
right.
show as well. So Steve's got a whole bunch of memorabilia for 50 years. He's got tons of his own art. There's artwork to buy.
Yeah.
Merch galore.
Posters,
and of course the show.
Yeah.
Is this going to be the Bruce Springsteen of all concerts where it goes on forever, or do they kick you out at a certain time? And so
I think we get kicked out, or they just start taking our stuff out.
Gene put together a dynamite set, like it's with some surprises, and it's going to be really fun, man.
That is again Saturday at 6:00.
Saturday, April 6th at 6:30.
There you go. So I got the 6 and the 6:30. Yeah. Saturday, April 6th, 6:30 at Carmen's if you want to see a slice of Hamiltonia. Yep. I don't even know if that's a word, but we're going with it.
Yep.
That is Teenage Head's 50th anniversary. Gene Champagne, Dave Ray, thanks
thank
for coming
Thank you
in,
so much, Scott. Man, thanks. That was awesome.
Yeah, let's play it out to a commercial with a little bit of Teenage Head back after this. Stay with
us.
Hey,
all right. Woo!
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.